warm.
I wish it was warmer. I wish it was a little warmer.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this June 12th. I'm really delighted to be here with the folks that are going to be talking to us. This is a very important issue facing the state and the nation, and it's great to have such fine experts available to help us. So I'll open an informational hearing on the opioid epidemic. And who's our first panel, Madam Administrator?
First panel that is already prepared to be to kick us off is Dwight Holton, Katrina Hedberg, and Safina Kurishish.
Go for it. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenleg, my name is Dwight Holton. I am the Executive Director of Lines for Life, a statewide nonprofit dedicated to preventing substance abuse and suicide. I'm very delighted to be here today with a very august set of panels. As I think you know, the Lines for Life has, at the behest of Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Governor's Office, 3 or 4 years ago, we launched a project to conduct regional summits around Oregon to develop regional action plans for reducing misuse, abuse, and overdose of opioids. And as part of that project, we have developed a kind of core group of faculty, if you will, that have been participating in these summits. And we've been so incredibly impressed with their ability to really distill the core issues that we had thought it might be helpful to come and share this product with you, if you will, come share this faculty with you. So that's what we'd like to do today, is give you some of the highlights that we've been using and some of the learning we've enjoyed, if you will, from our regional summits around the state. As Dr. Hedberg will elucidate on, we really come down to kind of three core components that we think are essential, four, I guess I'll say, core components that we think are essential to addressing the opioid crisis. Number one, we need to be prescribing less pills. We are still prescribing on the order of 290 million opioid pills in Oregon every 12 months, 70 for every man, woman, and child. So number one is to do a better job of prescribing. Number two, we need to be better about pain management, because it turns out that we have treated pain poorly in this state and elsewhere. The science has been wrong, and we need to do a better job so that we don't continue to grow the number of people who are dependent on opioids. Number three, we need to engage in harm reduction strategies like medication-assisted treatment and like naloxone distribution, so that we can address the impacts of the opioid crisis and try and stop the downstream challenges. And then four, we need to use data and really have public and private provider education shot through all of the other three objectives. So I'm delighted to be here to share these incredibly smart and thoughtful people who have been leading these efforts around the state and who have been such a huge part of our success in those. Now, we've done six summits. We've got two more on the horizon. We're delighted to be a part of it. And without further ado, I'll ask the state public health officer to kind of set the table for us on data.
Yeah.
So thank you. Chair Greenleg, members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg. I am the state epidemiologist and health officer with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And as Mr. Holden said, I know I've spoken to all of you earlier, both about opioids in general and then about some specific legislation. So I think my task today is to give you, again, a little bit brief overview of what the data are and of the initiative that we have here in Oregon. This first slide, I actually put this up with the schematic there of Bayer, which produced heroin back in the early 1900s as one of the treatments for pain. And of course, now we find this shocking that heroin was actually a prescription medication, and we know the side effects that that has caused, if you will. And part of the reason to address this is we're learning more and more all of the time, and I think it's important that we keep in mind that even what we know to be true today are things that are going to be evolving and changing in the future. So if we look at the impact, and again, I have presented this before, but there are a lot of people who are living with some aspect of chronic pain. About 20% of Oregonians report it on surveys. As Dwight just mentioned, almost one in four Oregonians received a prescription for opioid medication. We are also tied, well, in 2012 and 13, second in the nation for non-medical use of opioids. Oregon has been somewhere in the top five. It sort of fluctuates over the past 10 years. So these extra unspent medications that sit on the shelf, people are taking those for non-medical purposes. Next. And again, this results in hospitalizations, both direct hospitalizations due to overdose, as well as opioid use disorder. So again, big impact in over $8 million in hospitalization charges alone. So that isn't to talk about all the indirect costs of treating people who have opioid use disorder. And opiates kill approximately 150 people in Oregon. So in 2014, that was 154. I'll present a little more data updated that number has started decline. Next. So this graph really shows kind of the most current data that we have deaths in Oregon. So the top, and I'm sorry, somehow this didn't translate between my computer and this one, but the top green line is prescription opiates. And these are overdose deaths. So as you can see, these peaked in the late 2000s and have declined since then, the green line. So that's the good news. One of the reasons that we started to see the decline in 2008, I think, was because methadone was taken off as a preferred drug. Methadone has a number of problems, including its very long half-life, and it's no longer preferred a drug within Medicaid. It was very inexpensive. It's good to treat pain, but it is also a very dangerous medication. The next lines there, if you look at heroin, that's the orange line, which had a slight increase and is relatively flat. So again, I could say that's the good news. The bad news is that red line that seems to be increasing. We're going to start teasing that out. This is psychotropic medication, so that's things like benzodiazepines, et cetera, that are prescription. It also includes, however, methamphetamine and other illicit drugs. So again, we're going to tease out that red line a little bit more, but we're quite concerned that number is increasing. Next.
So did you cite the prescription or the non-prescription piece?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you said that's both prescription and non-prescription.
Yeah, Chair Greenlee.
Which do you think is causing the problem?
So I think that in large part we're seeing an increase in the deaths related to methamphetamine. So again, we need to, and I don't have it specifically today, but we've also started to see the same problem that that other parts of the country have seen around fentanyl. Now that is an opiate derivative, but it's not heroin, it's not a prescription opiate, but starting to see an increase in fentanyl deaths. It's still less than 10 a year, but again, it's really very alarming because people take this drug and they often die within the order of a few hours after taking it.
Oh,
so we do need to tease that out. More. So if we look at the hospitalizations, again, the top line there are the psychotropic medications, so fewer hospitalizations, which in my mind may mean that actually people are dying very quickly and don't end up being hospitalized. The blue line is any opioid, and we have started to see a decline in in hospitalizations due to any opioid. Prescription is green, so again, that's the good news. And heroin, again, is chugging along at the bottom with a very slight increase. So we need to keep our eye out for that as well. Next. Now, this is where the good news starts. We have been looking at opioid prescribing, so controlled substance prescribing. What you can see here, again, it looks pretty flat, but starting in the end of 2015, again, the third quarter and fourth quarter, we've seen a pretty steady decline. It's only on the order of 10%, so what I would say is we aren't there yet, but we are starting to see inroads in the number of prescriptions of opioids that are being seen. So I attribute this. People say, well, is this because of your guidelines or is it because of one thing? I really do believe, and that's part of what we're here to talk about, is that it takes a concerted effort. It's a comprehensive. There, unfortunately, we'd love it if there was one thing. You implement a guideline, everybody follows it, problem solved. That is not the case. It does take a concerted effort to address the number of different things that Mr. Holton spoke about. Next. And this slide is my last data slide, but shows prescribing by age. So the main takeaway point there is actually that top green line. That's the patients who are 45 to 64 years of age. And the reason to pay attention to this, some of the prescribing that's happening of opiates in older population can be due to cancer and or end-of-life care. Within our PDMP, we don't have the ability to tease that out. Mm. So if you take, so that's the red line for the older and the purple. Those are kind of flat, although they've gone slightly. We're really worried about chronic pain patients getting opioids. And so, again, people, takes a while to develop chronic pain. So that 45 to 64-year-old, we estimate, can't say for sure, but a lot of that is opiates for chronic pain, and we really have seen an impact on that particular population. Next. So, as I just mentioned, this isn't going to take one effort. This really takes a variety of efforts. And it really, this is an example of, you've all heard about the public health modernization. This, as Director Lillian Shirley says, part of that modernization is to get lots of other people to think about what public health, how they can contribute to public health efforts. So within that, as Dwight mentioned, we need better pain treatment. Again, we aren't the people within Oregon Health Authority who are doing that directly, or I should say the public health, but there are things like our Medicaid prescribing guidelines and the HERC Health Evidence Review Commission looking at alternate therapy for chronic pain, such as acupuncture, occupational therapy, etc. Reducing the harms, and again, we've spent a lot, and Representative Buehler has been instrumental in previous legislation around making naloxone available behind the counter by prescription by pharmacists. Very helpful in this. As you know, we recently got SAMHSA funding at the Oregon Health Authority to expand the use of medication-assisted treatment around the state. And then real efforts at focusing on reducing those pills in circulation, again, through a couple of things, the prescribing guidelines, which we had finalized and endorsed last fall, but are now being, endorsed by a number of the associations and licensing boards, et cetera, across the state. And we're in the process of developing implementation in various regions throughout the state, again, as Dwight Holden was mentioning, the summits that are happening. And then last but not least, we are here to bring you the data to see whether or not we're actually making an impact on these factors. And we have a data dashboard that I think I've talked to you all about before. So with that, I don't know if you want questions for me or wait for Dr. Qureshi.
We're happy to keep moving or take questions.
What's your pleasure?
Whatever you prefer. Keep going.
Keep rolling.
So thanks, Dr. Hedberg. I'll highlight this slide. One of the byproducts and benefits of the fact that we at Lines for Life, working with OHA and with local public health officers and kind of the full panoply of folks from treatment to law enforcement to education, one of the byproducts of having pulled that group together is that we've become somewhat of a center of gravity so that we're all aligned. Whether you talk to someone in the treatment world or someone at public health or someone in law enforcement, these four objectives are where we all have landed because we're kind of constantly working together in that room, literal and figurative, whether it's at Lines for Life or OHA. It's been a really successful model, I think, in a way that we hadn't expected, but it's turned out to be quite cool. I'll emphasize one of the things that Dr. Hedberg noted about the arrival of fentanyl and carfentanyl, the synthetic fentanyl that's coming from China. It's remarkably potent. You see eastern cities where it has hit hard, places like Ohio and New Hampshire, that will all of a sudden in a weekend have 50 to 60 overdoses. Not all deaths, but 50 to 60 overdoses in a weekend. First responders are finding that it will take 10, 11, 12 shots of naloxone, the opioid overdose antidote, to revive someone from an overdose when normally one will do the trick. It is a remarkably potent pill, form of opioid. And we're working closely with Oregon Health Authority as well as with law enforcement, the high-intensity drug trafficking folks, to create a response and essentially early warning system for when it gets here in numbers. The numbers right now look like we had a couple years ago. We had a couple more the year after that. Last year we had, I think you said, 7 deaths, right? But when it's in B.C. very prominently right now, in British Columbia, as Dr. Korthus can address, if it gets here in the same force, we're talking about hundreds of people dying every year.
What's the mode of administration? What's the mode of administration?
It's granular. And it can be mixed and snorted, mixed and injected. And we heard, if I understood correctly, from PSU had a challenge last year where people were putting it in drinks, in alcohol drinks.
Yes, so Chair Greenlich, I think that the problem with fentanyl is that sometimes people are taking it because they think they're taking it directly, so and that they're going to get high from it. But they're often using fentanyl to cut other drugs, so they may think that they're getting meth or methamphetamine or getting cocaine. So the different routes of administration or heroin. Yeah, it's often used within, you know, with heroin as well. So depending on how they're taking, if you will, the primary drug or what they think, whether they're snorting or injecting heroin or, you know, smoking meth or whatever it might be, the fentanyl is included, sometimes included in that. Or pills.
So, as we mentioned, reduce the number of pills is one of our key priorities. I want to start there with Dr. Qureshi for time reasons. I will note that one of the reasons this is so important is because the prescribing of opioids is what has really opened the, turned on the spigot, if you will. And I want to call your attention to two facts in particular here that on that third bullet down, or fifth bullet, sorry, 47% of patients who are on opioids for just 30 days are on them still 3 years later. So you have a roughly 50-50% chance if you're on a 30-day course of opioids to still be on them 3 years later. If you are on opioids for 90 days, there is a 60% likelihood that you are still taking those opioids in 5 years. So getting the prescribing part of this right is a central part of the problem. With that, I'll introduce Dr. Qureshi. Dr. Smita Qureshi is the chief medical officer of the Columbia Pacific CCO, which embraces Columbia, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. They have been undertaking all sorts of innovative projects around better prescribing, and they conducted, we had our summit with them a year ago, April, and just in this April, this May, they had their follow-up summit, purely organic. It was delightful for me to go to a summit and have both nothing to do, but also know that we planted the seeds that were really blossoming with care and thought with folks like Dr. Qureshi. So, Safina.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. What I wanted to, can you go to the first one? What I wanted to talk about is just give you an example of how we are within our region approaching the improved clinical prescribing. This driver diagram, you don't need to read it all, but it really just shows the complexities of the entire opioid issue, epidemic, and how various areas are approaching it from so many different perspectives, like Dr. Hedberg and Mr. Holton have been talking about. But I'm going to focus on limiting supply of opioids, specifically what we've been doing about improved clinical prescribing, and then I'll mention what we've also been doing about drug take-back boxes. So the difference of what we've been doing is a regional effort. So it's very different to lead this effort within a region of three different counties than it is to do it within one organization. You need all the organizations and the community and the local leaders' buy-in in order to do this. And so much of our energy and effort has been working with clinical leaders throughout the region over the last couple years to really talk about the data, talk about the risks and benefits, and get everybody on board. We have a clinical advisory panel who met to review the CDC data regarding the harms, at what levels the biggest harms occurred. And we also talked about the fact that, you know, we had been trying to address the opioid issue for about 4 years. And for 2 years, you know, clinicians were like, yeah, we're doing this. But when we pulled the data at the end of 2015, there wasn't any improvement. So it really reflects the huge need to continuously share data with clinicians to say, are we improving or are we not? And if we're not, what are we doing wrong? So we pulled together the clinical advisory panel, and together they developed regional goals based on data. And this was in the April of 2016. And they also advised on a strategy to achieve these goals.
What did the risk score study show?
hard
so
to read.
Those are four studies. Those are four studies that were four of the major studies that the CDC looked at when creating the CDC guidelines. So what it shows is the level of morphine equivalent dose, so the level of opioids at which overdose harm occurs, and they found that, you know, really the biggest inflection happened, the start of harm happens at 50 morphine equivalents, with increased harm at 90, and then it goes up from there. This just very briefly shows what the clinical advisory panel came up with regarding tiered goals over 4 years to address the highest risk populations of those who are co-prescribed things like benzodiazepines and opioids that oftentimes cause the increased amount of death, and then the highest dose opioids. So really the whole point of this slide is just to say that they decided for 50 MED as their regional goal based on the data, and that all the clinical leaders within the region are on board with this. Not to say that that's easy. They still have to do so much work, and I have been working really hard on it. But they've decided that's the goal, and they've decided to kind of help their clinicians kind of move forward in this direction over a few years. But like Dr. Hedberg said, just because you have guidelines or just because you have a goal does not mean that gets you anywhere. And so we've been doing a lot of work within the region to do education with primary care providers, starting education with emergency department physicians, dentists, et cetera, to talk about acute prescribing, surgeons as well, to really educate regarding the opioid epidemic and the harms associated with it that you heard a little bit about a little bit earlier. We developed a pledge to have providers make commitments to moving towards this goal. We updated the guidelines and made them very, very granular to help organizations really move forward with this work. And we did trainings for Oregon Prescription Drug Monitoring Program and to get people signed up for it that weren't signed up for it. And then we've held regional quarterly of practice meetings to allow providers an opportunity to talk about what's difficult with this, because it is really difficult work. And
what's the approximate number of providers you have in the three counties?
In the three counties, I would say at least 200, maybe 300, but that might just be primary care.
Fairly large number.
Yeah.
Please just speak up, you.
Personal.
Perfect. I have a question.
Yeah.
you mentioned prescription monitoring programs. Are those pharmacies? Can you give me more?
Yeah. So the Oregon.
Question.
So, I think now every state in the country has a prescription drug monitoring program, except for one.
Missouri.
Okay. That's what I thought. So basically, anytime a clinician prescribes a controlled substance, it is registered when it is dispensed. And so the pharmacy registers it. So then when I go to prescribe another prescription,
if I decide to go to another pharmacist, it'll show up that I already got.
If they check it, but you have to check it, and so you have to check it as a physician and you have to check it as a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. So it does require being active and like having to sign in and check it, but it's really helpful to say what are all the controlled substances people are getting and are they getting it from somewhere else and things like that.
And we've made it easier to allow staff to be involved. So
yeah.
That's right.
So now there can be a delegate.
That's right. Yeah. Two year sessions ago, maybe, you amended the bill to allow medical assistants to be delegates or others to be delegates so that the physician doesn't have to be the one herself or himself checking it. But all of the data, or the bulk of the data that Dr. Hedberg presented, all comes from the PDMP. It's a remarkably valuable tool at figuring out how to target our efforts on prevention and address the challenge.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank
you, Chair Greenlee. I have a question you may or may not get to, and it may be difficult to get this information out, but I would be curious if you're trying to track what day or days of the week prescriptions are prescribed. And my question leads to on-call systems in healthcare. Often healthcare providers cover for each other, right? Like there might be one dentist on call for the weekend for a group practice, or a physician on call for a group practice, or nurse practitioner, or whatnot. And I'm wondering if there's any, the PDMP, they might go in and get that prescription filled on Monday because it's not opened on Saturday or Sunday, or difficult for them to get. But I'm wondering if there's any way to tease out whether it was a primary care physician or whether it was an on-call healthcare provider, and do we look at any of that kind of data?
So as far as from my perspective, we don't look at it from a population perspective in terms of pulling it and parsing it out. But from an individual perspective, when you look at the PDMP, you could see who the prescriber was. So you can know, was it a primary care provider, if you know the provider. So if I'm I am a primary care provider. So if I'm a primary care provider, I would know, was it someone in my practice? Was it somebody in the ED? Was it somebody, a dentist and something like that? So you're able to know that.
Yeah, okay, I get that. I'm asking, do you look at trends of, basically I'm getting at, do you look at trends of on-call coverage versus primary
that's a really
care?
Interesting question.
And we can only, public health can pull trend data, so I think Dr. Hedberg.
Yeah, so Chair Greenock and Representative Hayden, it's a very good question, but looking at the date. But, you know, one of the issues that we have is that, let's say, in your practice, different people are taking call for each other. We wouldn't know. We would say, dental practice. We wouldn't know who was covering for what, as opposed to whom was prescribing directly for that patient. So the PDMP is a very rich data source when we're looking at trends over time and how many percent of patients over 120 MED, or, you know, which providers might be prescribing. But it isn't a very robust tool when it comes for reasons for prescribing and where they might be. Now,
but you do have patient data. And one of the interesting questions that raises to me is how many different physicians are prescribing for an individual patient.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me when there are multiple physicians prescribing, multiple providers, you have more of a problem.
That's right. That's a risk.
Yeah,
and has that changed since we've had it easier to look at them?
Yeah, so Chair Greenlick, yes, you're absolutely right. One of the flags that we have, if you will, red flags, but are people who see at least four different providers and or get prescriptions filled at four different pharmacies. And another one of the flags might be whether they are paying cash. We in Oregon can't tell. That's not one of the things that gets collected, PDMP, method of payment. But those are the kinds of flags that we could have, that this might be a patient who's risky. That's a slightly different question than, is it a provider who is prescribing, you know, with some risky practice. So you sort of have to address both what's happening on the provider side of things, as well as what's happening with patients who might be going to multiple providers. So again, it's complicated. The day of the week, that's a good question, and I'll have to see what we can do about prescribing, because again, on a Saturday or Sunday is very different than something that might be happening within a primary care setting during the week.
Yeah, but often that might not be filled till the Monday morning or whatever. But kind of the point is, you've got these on-call, you know, these group practices. We all do it, I think. You've got on-call, and, you know, we got access to that data if we go look it up and yada, yada, yada. But my theory would be that there might be an opportunity for education for specifically on-call times. Like, I take X amount of weekends a year, and I cover X amount of offices.
It's Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, and how many get called in Friday after 12 before, you know, Monday 8 a.m., that kind of thing.
So, Chair Greenlick and Representative Hayden, one of the things that we have looked at within, you're aware of the Oregon prescribing guidelines, I mentioned those, but some different provider groups have also their own guidelines which act synergistically. So the two that might be relevant would be dental prescribing guidelines and what happens after certain dental procedures. The other would be the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians, so the Oregon chapter of ASAP, but actually had prescribing guidelines for emergency departments that preceded our Oregon guidelines, that we're talking about things like don't prescribe for 30 days, a minimum dose, make sure that you're referring people back to their primary care provider. So even if the on-call is prescribing, they aren't prescribing a huge amount of pills. They're prescribing a small amount that might carry the patient over to again, that the primary person who should be prescribing all of these opiates would be the primary care provider. So other groups have tried to address the issue, but we can see whether or not our data can address that issue at all.
Thank you.
And then regarding the primary care provider, so the guidelines that we're endorsing, that many organizations are adopting, and every organization I've been part of, is no controlled substances after hours or on weekends. And so when you have an agreement with a patient who's on opioid medications, part of the agreement is you come in for your appointment and it's not after hours. And if it is after hours, if you call after hours, then you need to have an evaluation because... So that has drastically in the last 10 years and just in personal experience drastically decreased with these protocols and procedures within organizations, I think, in a really good way. And then one of the things regarding data, so we have different data than state data. So we have claims data. So we're able to see who is prescribing, who the top prescribers are, and create and what's the amount that's being prescribed at various different risk categories within the region for each organization. So we've created specific dashboards for each organization to allow them to monitor their data. Granted, it's only for patients on Medicaid, but it's something especially for organizations who don't have the capacity to pull their EMR data, and it's pretty hard when it comes to opioids. So we distribute that quarterly along with a patient list. So patients, their actual names, so that they can sort that out and kind of do targeted interventions as needed for that. We've also started behavior-based pain clinics, which I'll talk about a little bit in a minute. And
doing that out of your claims data, not out of the PDMP.
Right. No, not out of the PDMP, because only public health can see data out of the PDMP. So we do this from claims data, so we can get individual level data, and we can red flag it, and then we can talk specifically to providers. So we could see within the CCO who are the top 10% of prescribers within the CCO, and then I individually talk to each of them and come up with a support plan for each of them. Okay.
Can you check, when you guys look at the PDMP, can you check which physicians or dentists or checked?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not the
Well, so when I look at the PDMP, you can see who's prescribed.
No, only your claims data.
Yeah, so I can.
For your patients?
Yeah, for my patients.
Yeah. So for
Chair Greenlick and representative, from a
population
CCO, from a public health look.
Not from the PDMP.
We understand that is one of the limitations of the PDMP, is the use is very specific for a provider and that provider's patients. We can give broad trend data, but there have been a number of policy suggestions to allow, for example, a medical director, whether it's CCO or a clinic director, who supervises physicians.
No, we didn't do that. Did it not get out of the center?
It's stuck in Ways and Means. It's 2518, so I'd greatly appreciate any assistance with moving it out of 2518 or out of the Ways and Means. It would be great.
Well, I think just to follow up very quickly on that, the point is if you have that, you know, generic information or specific information, then you could start to incentivize practitioners to actually look it up ahead of time and have some sort of incentive for them to do that. Now it's kind of a voluntary, maybe we do, maybe we don't.
So
go ahead. If I may, that's what 2518 does. It creates an oversight to intervene and use an educational component if a provider is prescribing out of the norms that would be expected. So.
We'll pass it.
we've done that out of this committee. So.
But I do think there's...
I assume it's done. Once it gets out of here.
Yeah.
I do think there's an incentive for providers to look at it because from an individual patient perspective, you can see that information, and so that is very helpful, even though it's not from an aggregate perspective.
Just to your punchline.
Just briefly, we did start behavior-based pain clinics, and the point of that is that when you're working with clinicians and providers to decrease opioid prescribing, you really need to improve the treatment of chronic pain and figure out better ways to treat that. And so we're funding that as well. And it's way more complicated than everything we said, but since April of 2016, when we really kind of honed in on this and shifted the work that we were doing, there's been about a 25% decrease in high-risk prescribing for opioids in our three counties, which is consistent with the trend that Dr. Hedberg had talked about. So that's what we wanted to share with you today.
So thank you very much. The other initiative I would note that Dr. Qureshi has had is a disposal box initiative with pharmacies and hospital systems in the ZCO. And while it is a very important start, there's more work to be done there. My view, having been doing this for a while now, is that we need to make it as easy to get rid of disused drugs as it is to get the drugs in the first place, and that means pharmacy-based disposal. So thank you very much.
I got away in on that.
Okay, me too.
Chair Greenlick, I completely agree with Dwight's comments, but the easiest way to get rid of drugs is to just put it in the trash according to the acceptable guidelines. And the only way for people to know to do that is a public education component, which is really lacking right now. And I certainly had hoped we still have time to pass that bill too.
I mean, I just picked up this last week. We picked up an envelope at the pharmacy and mailed a bag. It was really easy.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's easy to mail or just put in the trash in appropriate disposal.
It was an easy envelope to put drugs in. You just take your tape off, seal it.
Yeah.
Put in the post office.
So we'll move to the next panel if that's acceptable. Yeah. Sure.
I just want to make a comment about that as well. I had the opportunity to attend a national opioid prevention conference with state legislators back in April, and it's really kind of cool to kind of see all this because Oregon's doing a lot more. Of course, we have a bigger problem than other places. But one thing that they really did emphasize was, you know, it's a multi-pronged problem, and like any other big problem, prevention is always the best option. And the majority of people that ultimately have opioid addictions started by taking pills out of medicine cabinets, trading with friends, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to be aware of programs that try to get out as many of these drugs out of circulation as possible. And the data is, I brought home from there, is tremendous about the importance of doing that, and as well as coordination of that rather than all the little community things doing that. And as Rep. Bueller referenced, this healthcare committee put forth a bill. It's in Ways and Means, and I'm hoping it will pass through, and we can be the first state in the country with our worst opioid addiction, right, to actually deal with this problem on that level as well.
Representative Mueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Just a couple, one comment and then one question. The comment is, I think you need to be careful when you quote the studies about people's rate of addiction after use. That's for treatment of chronic pain, not acute pain. So to mix up the treatment of acute and chronic pain, I think we need to make sure when we're talking about it, because it's a very different situation. But the question here is, what are you going to do to help protect people against the inevitable influx of fentanyl and the synthetic fentanyls? You may not have an answer to that, but I really think you need to start thinking about it, because it's going to arrive, and it's a really difficult problem, because the amounts, you know, that can kill people are in the microgram level. And so it's not like heroin and even narcotic pills where you have a large volume, it's easier to find for law enforcement. These are shipped directly from Asia in very small amounts.
So, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller. Yeah, the way that I look at this is that it can be a huge number of issues, and to try to sort of figure out, if you will, what are the pieces to address. So when we started to look at this, of course, prescription opiates were where we started. Guidelines are going to make a difference for prescription opiates, as an example. They won't make a dent in fentanyl. Now, there is overlap because a lot of these people start, as we just said, with a prescription medication and are taking prescription drugs that then may move over into heroin and others. So there is overlap. When it comes to illicit drugs, there are a number of strategies. So as Dwight always said, naloxone is very important, but it looks like the amount of naloxone you need to reverse a fentanyl overdose is many times higher. But one of the things that we are working very closely with are different parts of law enforcement. So we work closely with our medical examiner's office, Dr. Karen Gunson and others, to see if they can identify if there's a death, what is the cause of death, that's how come we know fentanyl, and to try to address, are there clusters, because you often see it might be a group of friends or other people who are getting medication. But how you address fentanyl, again, is involves collaboration with law enforcement, with the high-intensity drug trafficking. Anyway, we have relationships with different parts of law enforcement that are dealing with that. Again, it's a different strategy than what we're dealing with prescription opiates. But again, I do know these aren't totally separate circles. There is overlap between the two.
Can we have the next group? Yeah.
Thank you. Sure. Todd and Julia, come on.
Is it Kat, Riona, and Nora?
Thanks for bringing up the difference between acute and chronic.
No, sorry, we're going to do Todd. This also. Our timing got messed up here. I'm sorry.
Okay, so.
Todd, for those.
We'll find out who we have.
Can I give one?
Chair Greenlick and committee members, thank you so much for really taking your time and attention to address this critical issue. I'm Todd Korthus. I'm a practicing general internist at OHSU and chief of the addiction medicine section there. I'd like to speak about three things. First of all, the nature of opioid use disorder. Secondly, treatment options that we have that give us some tools to really address this. And third, opportunities for improving access to treatment in Oregon. So the first point is that opioid use disorder is a chronic illness. Sometimes there's a common perception that opioid use disorder is due to a lack of willpower or moral character. And while initial opioid use may begin with poor choices, by the time people develop opioid use disorders, it really follows a pattern much more similar to asthma or diabetes. For example, even though asthma is a potentially fatal illness, the people who take their asthma medications regularly, they avoid the environmental stimuli that precipitate exacerbations, tend to turn those good weeks into good years and beyond. Opioid use disorder is exactly the same way. And the goal of the healthcare system is to help people turn those good days and sometimes weeks into good months and years, and then pick up where we left off when there's a bump in the road. So the second point I'd like to make is that medication treatment works. And this is critical. Without medications for treatment of opioid use disorder, over 90% of people will relapse within 12 months. With medications to treat opioid use disorder, about 50% of people will relapse within 12 months. So the good news is we have three highly potent, very effective treatments for opioid use disorder. And in the interest of time, I won't belabor them. I will just say buprenorphine, methadone, and now extended-release naltrexone are all FDA-approved and highly effective for the treatment of opioid use disorder. Buprenorphine is particularly nice in that it can be used in primary care outside of specialty treatment settings. And I'll just tell you one story. This is a patient, we'll call her Sarah, a 53-year-old lady who suffered a femur fracture after a motor vehicle accident. She was treated initially very appropriately with oxycodone for her bone pain. This ultimately was complicated by by infection of the hardware, ongoing requirements for opioids. One thing led to another, and the opioid requirements were escalating. She was receiving oxycodone now from several providers. Her primary care doc that was now managing her chronic opioids decided that they could no longer work together. She resorted to internet purchases of various opioids and developed a number of complications in her life. She was ultimately admitted to the hospital at OHSU, where we met her, switched her to buprenorphine, and now she is again practicing as an accountant in her community on a stable dose of buprenorphine, and her pain issues have completely resolved.
You're about the first doctor in Oregon to use buprenorphine.
Pardon?
Weren't you about the first doctor in Oregon?
I was one of two, yes. Yeah. And I'm excited to see that expanding. I'll just move on to some of the challenges and opportunities for expanding opioid use disorder treatment in Oregon. Right now, only 1 in 10 people with opioid use disorder actually are receiving treatment. We have to dramatically expand access to care and lower barriers to care. So I'm just going to briefly talk about 3 potential challenges that we're facing and some potential solutions and opportunities that might address those challenges. One of the big challenges I see is right now the rural urban disparity in opioid use disorder in Oregon. Those of you representing rural counties are really up against quite a lot with opioid use disorder, where the rates of opioid overdose per capita actually exceed the state average in many rural counties in Central Oregon and the Southern Coast. Some opportunities for addressing this include models that have been developed, such as hub-and-spoke models, where you have a center of excellence or expertise in a community. And I'll just throw out one potential example of ADAPT in Roseburg that can then establish relationships for dispensing and supporting providers in surrounding counties that have no access to methadone treatment or buprenorphine. A second potential opportunity is the expansion of the addiction medicine telehealth initiative called ECHO for medication-assisted treatment that we just started at OHSU. It's other places around the country. This is a 20-week course that primary care providers sign up for, and they spend their lunch hour 1 hour a week for 20 weeks logging on remotely to a teleconference where we have about 20 minutes of didactics on an addiction medicine subject, and then they present their real-world cases right in front of them that week, and then get an interdisciplinary, detailed amount of feedback about how to optimize care for that patient, as well as written comments afterwards. We just finished our first 20-week session. It was extremely well-received, and we're hoping to expand that program. A third potential opportunity here is the role of rural peer navigators. These have been successfully deployed in urban areas. There are some interesting models of using people actually in recovery to go out into their communities in, you know, among the people that they already know and directly link those people with care and treatment. And we have a proposal for evaluating a program like that in the near future. A second challenge that I see is really a limited workforce. And so I'm very, very excited to see potential opportunities in workforce development. And I'll just mention a few. Expansion of buprenorphine training. Right now, only 5%, about 550 providers of Oregon's 11,000 docs actually are certified to prescribe buprenorphine. It seems like a missed opportunity that there are more oxycodone prescribers than buprenorphine prescribers in Oregon. So expanding opportunities for treatment for training of these providers would be a real benefit. We've been working on an initiative going around the state providing these waivers waiver trainings that allow a provider to prescribe, and have you trained 157 in the last year.
Can you just take a moment and describe why buprenorphine is better than, say, oxycodone?
Buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist, which means that it attaches to the opioid receptor and only partly activates it. Still has analgesic effect for controlling pain, but no matter how much more you take after a certain level, you can't get any more effect. And so it's extremely difficult to overdose on buprenorphine, making it much safer than any other opioid available right now. It's also quite long-acting and blocks the effect of, for example, oxycodone or heroin if you try to inject on top of it, so you don't get any benefit and people stop using. It's as effective as methadone in clinical trials. Another opportunity for workforce expansion, nurse practitioners and physician's assistants were just approved in the last few months for prescribing buprenorphine, and we need to ramp up the capacity to train up our workforce that really provide a tremendous amount of primary care in rural Oregon and elsewhere. Multidisciplinary addiction medicine fellowships. We just started our first fellowship in addiction medicine, a one-year clinical program a few years ago now. We have about 17 to 20 applications per year, and I right now can only accept one to two due to resource issues. I'm going to wrap this up and talk about one last challenge, insurance coverage and prior authorizations. And there have been some exciting opportunities. One that's right in front of this group right now is House Bill 3440 in Ways and Means Committee that is proposing to remove prior authorizations for people in those first 30 days of treatment. I'd love to see that passed.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Ms. Pence.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm very happy to be here, very grateful for this opportunity to address you. I am Julia Pinsky, and I have with my family, we have started a small nonprofit in Southern Oregon called Max's Mission. We primarily distribute free naloxone. We educate, inform, train communities about naloxone. We have had the support of Dr. Shames, who's been a very integral part of us being able to do this, and the Oregon Pain Guidance Group, as well as All Care and many other healthcare professionals in Southern Oregon, because they realize that there's a huge ignorance among the general public about even what naloxone is. So out of that, we started last November, realizing that the county wasn't able to do what we saw needed to be done, which was a grassroots effort. Since that time, we have had four community meetings, Medford, Grants Pass, Ashland, and Cave Junction, and we are back in Medford again next week. When we go into a community, we first of all call pharmacists. We find out what pharmacists are prescribing, who are only dispensing, how does that work for them? Is there any demand? How do they, you know? And then if they aren't prescribing, which a lot are not, to be honest, even though we know the law has changed, a lot didn't even know they could prescribe. Then Mark Cantor, who is head pharmacist at All Care, has been very helpful in talking to those pharmacists. But it is it's a lot of information to get out there. The Oregon Board of Pharmacy has also done work, but there's still a lot needs to be done. We then work with local media. We try to we get articles in the local paper. Local television has covered us extensively. We are very grateful for that because it's a topic that is that they know needs to be covered and that they should be covering. And so we've had JPR, we've had KTV, we've had all the local television stations. They come to our meetings. Our meetings have a format where, say, a doctor speaks, Dr. Shames has spoken, Dr. Miller. We then have Mark, who is the pharmacist, who talks about naloxone, what it does, how it works. We then have a local person from law enforcement, which hopefully is carrying naloxone. So Medford has been a pioneer in this, and they have come, they talk about the work they do, and as well as that in Grants Pass, we had the chief safety officer there, and it's wonderful for the community to hear how their local police force is meeting this huge problem and saving lives. Medford has saved 23 lives in a couple of years that they've been doing this. We do advertising, we put out flyers, we talk to people in the community, and then we get a wide variety of people who come to these meetings, from illicit drug users, prescription drug users whose doctors are not giving them naloxone, they've heard about naloxone, family of drug users, agencies, many counseling agencies, from ADAPT, from OnTrack, local doctors, local pharmacists come. So it's a very mixed group, but it starts the conversation in the community about their drug problem. Some communities will own their drug problem, but this is what we've found so far, and some don't. Some are sort of in denial. But it does start the whole ball rolling, and the importance of getting naloxone into the hands of people that can use it, family members, drug users. Drug users save other drug users, and it just isn't there at the moment. And the pharmacists, when we have these meetings, we give out statements of completion, which people can then take to their pharmacist. We've set up with the pharmacist that they will take these statements of completion. We sign off on the training, and then they can go to their pharmacist and get the naloxone, which technically shouldn't be necessary, but still very much is. There are large areas where there is no prescribing of naloxone. We know that we recently did, just over the weekend, a small survey of Bend and Roseburg and Salem, and there's plenty of pharmacies there's quite a few who are prescribing, but there's no demand. And what I would say from that is people just don't realize they can go to their pharmacy and get naloxone. So I think there's a lot more room for community outreach in that way. So why I am so passionate about getting naloxone out there was that my eldest son died from an overdose about 4 years ago. So we lived in a rural area just outside of Ashland. He had a heroin use problem for about a year. Before that, he was working. He was high functioning, wonderful. But when he started using heroin, it was a very, very quick downhill spiral. And it was a horrendous year. We found him in our office, passed out, overdosed. We didn't have naloxone. I didn't even know what naloxone was at that point. It took about 20 minutes for emergency services to get there, and that was too late. A few months prior to that, his close friend had also died from a heroin overdose. And then prior to that, this was in Ashland, all in Ashland, a few weeks before that, there was a young man who worked at Shakespeare Festival, and he had died of a heroin overdose. And then after Max died, about 6 weeks after that, one of our very closest friends, whose son had just come back from Texas, he was a 20-year-old young man. He had been clean for 6 months. They were on their way to Florida. They were in a hotel room picking up their things and gathering things to move. He went out and got some heroin, and he died in the hotel bathroom. So in a very short space of time, four young men were gone. And so after that, I did a lot of research about trying to make sense of what had happened. Not that there's any sense to what happened, but could that have been a different story? And of course, I realized that that naloxone would have made a difference. Maybe for us, if we'd had it, it would have made a difference. And maybe for Andrew, if his dad had it, it would have made a difference. So I followed the news. I kept on Googling naloxone in the Rogue Valley, naloxone in Southern Oregon. Nothing ever came up. And I saw laws changing around the country. So finally, last year, I called Dr. Shames, who was our county medical director, and he invited me to join the OPG naloxone support group. And out of that, a big learning process for me, and we formed Max's Mission, because to get naloxone out to where it's needed, into your communities, our communities, into the hands of families that need it.
Representative Eliza Leon.
Yes, this was, thank you, Chair. This is a question for the prior speaker.
I wanted to just kind of better understand the Rural Navigators program that you mentioned, understanding that 1 in 10 people are receiving treatment, which obviously sounds like this program is aiming to reach out to folks who are not familiar with the different treatments available. Can you tell me a little bit, can you expand a little bit more about that program?
Right, it's in the very early phases right now, mainly run through HIV Alliance out of Eugene, and they have peer counselors that go and talk with people and do syringe exchange right now. In some cases, they'll give them naloxone rescue kits.
Right, we work with HIV Alliance.
Perfect, great organization.
Yes.
And we're hoping to expand on that and formalize some of those outreaches to connect them directly with primary care docs in the area who are training to prescribe buprenorphine.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pinsky. We really appreciate it. The naloxone is a great future chapter for us, and their goal really being to turn that naloxone moment into a treatment moment, and we're all racking our brains on how best to do that. With your leave, I'd like to bring up the last couple of folks, members from the Pain Commission.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you, Max's mom, for coming this far and for turning your pain into something that will help so many other families.
Thank you. What I would like to say is I would like to see naloxone given out into emergency departments in hospitals. Right now that doesn't happen, as well as the treatment moments in hospitals, but that really, really needs to happen. It is almost criminal that it doesn't, to be honest.
Co-prescribing naloxone with opioids is something else that we think we need to take a lot harder look at.
Yeah. Thank you.
Given it. Distributed to people.
We're going to shorten it. Otherwise, you do the
so I appreciate very much the patience and indulgence of Dr. Kat Buest and Nora Stern. Nora, a physical therapist from Providence. Kat, a pain behavioral psychologist from OHSU, and both members of the Oregon Pain Commission, Kat being chair currently.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here today. And I'm going to just shorten this up because you guys have been sitting here longer than I think we all expected. So my main message is that... My name is Dr. Katriana Buest, pain psychologist. I've been doing this work for 20 years. And I have a case coming up that I wanted to present that is not uncommon. But the main message that I wanted to get across is that what I have seen personally is that the opioids, we've had this epidemic, but we've also had this epidemic of pain. And it's not been treated very well. And so we need to do something different. I know Oregon is taking a lead in many different areas that other parts of the country are looking at very closely, and I think we can make some significant changes. Opioids, in my opinion, have been used a lot for mental health issues, so kind of putting a big baby blanket often on anxiety and depression and stress, and that's very unfortunate. And oftentimes when people come off them, they actually start to get their life back again. So. Can you move to the next one? This is from the IOM report, and then we also have a national pain strategy that came out in 2016 that really gives some good guidelines about what we could be doing differently across the country. So the main issue is that a lot of patients don't have a good understanding about pain. They have the expectation that the pain will go away, and so another pill, another injection is going to do it to them or for them, which we know is not the case. Really, the best treatment is a multidisciplinary approach. And the unfortunate thing about that is that we don't have good access to that in many areas around the state. And the other thing is that we have a lot of clinicians who are being pumped out of schools that really have very minimal understanding about chronic pain in general. And so we're doing a better effort around the state of Oregon to try and improve the pain education. Back off there a
little too close to the microphone.
Okay, right. No. And so trying to do a better job of educating the physicians and the providers who come out of school so they have a better understanding. And, in fact, OHSU, I think we have the highest number of hours for the physicians coming out of any medical school in the country. And then, so I've already we can go on to the next one, which is the case. This is actually a 37-year-old female. This is a stock photo, whom I evaluated last week, and she came into my office. She's from about 30 minutes from here out in the rural area, and she had a hysterectomy about 8 years ago, and she's been in bed ever since with chronic pain, over-medicated. She's on 100 MED. Her kids bring her food and water, and she is not engaging in life at all, and very high depression and anxiety, of course, because she's given up all the activities that give her any kind of pleasure and enjoyment. Of course, she's not working right now either, so lost a lot of meaning in life. And 37, yeah, so no other treatment offered to her, despite the fact that there are lots of things out there. I think the providers don't always know what those resources are, so we're trying to do a better job of that in Oregon. And her goal to me was, I want to get my life back. And so there's a lot of things that she could do to get towards that goal, but she needs to find the right team of people to really make that happen for her. So I'm going to pass it along to Nora.
Thank you. Excuse me, Nora Stern. I'm a physical therapist by training. I've worked with complex persistent pain for 22 years, and I primarily focus on pain education for clinicians and patients. And this patient kind of depicts the exact problem that we have with how we approach pain in this country, which is that our whole society has considered pain to be something that resides in the body. And so if you have pain that has been persisting, then you have to continue to look for the source of the problem. And you look for the source of the problem in the tissues. And so patients do that, and they don't find answers. And one good way to illustrate the discrepancy here is that about 50 to 85% of people with severe degeneration on an X-ray have no symptoms. So the body is not actually where pain resides. Pain is actually a complex biopsychosocial phenomenon, and we have to treat pain in a complex biopsychosocial way. But our patients think that the pain is actually indicating that there's something ongoingly harmful in the body that needs to be either anesthetized with medication or removed with surgery. And that is not the case. Patients believe that, and unfortunately, the physicians treating them often don't really have that paradigm shift in their heads as well, because this is a fairly new way of understanding pain that has come about in the last 10 to 15 years. So you can go to the next one. So what we really need is a shift in the understanding on the part of patients of what pain is and how to go about what their role is in understanding what they can do to change their pain experience. And if clinicians across the whole continuum of care understand pain differently, they will direct people like that patient in a completely different way 5 years, 6 years back, and they would never have gotten into that place. So we have some good news about what Oregon is doing right, and in fact, as much as we still have a lot of problems, we do lead the nation in innovations. And if you go to any national conferences, people are looking to us for answers. Mm-hmm. The HERC guidelines, which have Oregon Health Authority put forward, have made it possible for people with low back pain to be treated, even if their condition is chronic, with a fairly decent spectrum of non-pharmacological options, chiropractic, acupuncture, behavioral health, and physical therapy that were not previously available. That is huge. There's a lot of clinicians who don't know that exists yet. We also have had quite a few professional training programs across the state that have started to change their pain education process. That doesn't cover all the clinicians who are out there practicing, right? But it is starting to change the people coming out. Mm-hmm. And we are in the process of upgrading our online required pain module for clinicians through Oregon State Pain Commission, which will begin to disseminate some of that information. And then we have a state website through Oregon Pain Guidance, and we have some telepain options. One of the biggest gaps, you can go to the next one, is that rural areas have huge lack of services and lack of awareness of what kinds of options might be available with a little more creativity and flexibility. So in terms of improving care, we still have a long ways to go. We need to expand coverage for non-pharmacological options beyond. So a good example would be non-pharmacological options for care outside of low back pain. The low back pain guideline is a fantastic example of how to do it differently and think about a cost shift. And so that's a huge opportunity, as well as looking at other coverage issues like what you do about somebody who has a large deductible. Could you think about a carve-out for
prevention kinds of services like behavioral health and PT. And then integrating care. Kat had mentioned multidisciplinary care, and the gold standard is multidisciplinary care. Everybody's working together. But the reality is that most clinicians are going to be working in their silos, and we need to have better ways of creating integrated communication. So that could include reimbursing for consults, reimbursing to participate in telepain, teleconsults, echo. There's no incentive to do that because you lose your productivity at this time. And then embedding the clinics that have begun to embed behavioral health or embed rehab PTOT in their primary care clinics, fantastic successes, and that should be encouraged in whatever way we can. And then focusing on public campaigns and clinic campaigns for that involve pain education, helping clinicians become better trained, and also reimbursing for pain education within clinical settings for more disciplines. And then other key areas like knowledge of substance use and informed trauma-informed care, which is emerging as a huge area associated with pain, because the incidence of trauma history in all chronic conditions, and pain is no exception, is enormous. So those are kind of the big highlights that we have. But basically, what we see is that in part, the opioid problem came about because clinicians were required to start asking about pain as the fifth vital sign about 20 years ago and didn't know what else to do besides pick up a prescription pad and a pen. And that was because of a lack of understanding of how pain really works and how to talk about pain with your patients differently. So that's a big lift, and it's the critical one that has to happen, because pain care needs to be everybody's job, not just the specialist when you get to OHSU, but every single clinician who touches a patient needs to talk about pain differently. And that's how we're going to turn it around, at least from the perspective of treating pain, which is not all of treating opioids. Thank you.
Thank you. Right, I think we need to wrap it up.
I have a quick comment. Nora, thank you for that information. I love the comprehensive thinking around pain and the shift and making sure that when we talk about pain, that it's that not just the patient, but all the doctors have to be in conversation around how to treat it. I'm particularly was taken back by the 37-year-old female that you both talked about, and how she was in pain for 8 years. I mean, that could be any of the women
story.
In here, right? And why 8 years of pain? I mean, like, aren't doctors, at what point did she get help from somebody else where somebody said, 8 years I've taken opioids, this is not okay? Right?
Right.
And then I think about, you know, I think beyond our English-speaking patients, I think about our bilingual patients or non-English-speaking patients or who culturally are not understanding of the way they're being treated and how they can advocate for themselves, right? So I guess part of the education is educating patients on how to advocate for themselves. And making sure the doctors have the latest and greatest information around how to treat pain, that it's not just opioids, but it's also suggestions for exercise, suggestions for acupuncture, alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to our doctor about that, you know, and how often that's recommended. Because I personally, I'm not a doctor, but I find it unacceptable that a woman is in pain for 8 years and cannot move, and that I don't know when finally another doctor stepped in and said that's unacceptable, we need to do something different.
And I think that it comes back to this fundamental kind of lack of comfort and understanding of what pain is, and to talk about it leads physicians to actually not even have that patient come in. They refill the prescription without the patient ever coming in because they don't know what to do. It freaks them out. And so when the clinicians understand pain, it's not, and become comfortable talking talking about it, you can have a conversation that then leads people to understanding what they can do to help themselves. But they have to understand pain differently before they believe that you're not pulling the wool over their eyes. Like, what do you mean you want me to decrease my stress? If they don't understand pain, that makes no sense. If they understand pain, it makes a lot of sense. So, well, that's the nugget.
We also need to focus on function and quality of life. Those really are the two outcomes that we're looking for, and it's been focused on pain. So you can have an 8 over 10 pain, which most a lot of the patients do, but they're out and they're taking their kids to the park and all that, and it's about those things are the most important things to be tracking.
So I hope, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity to share this kind of incredible learning that we've been going through. I'll leave you. I'm convinced that if we pursue these three strategies, we do better around prescribing, we do better on pain management, and we do better on the harm reduction piece with treatment and naloxone, we will continue to push that curve down, the overdose curve, et cetera, down. I'll leave you. I've heard that perhaps some of you are thinking about budget numbers around this building these days. I'll leave you with a CDC chart that indicates per every death what you can expect in terms of life and system costs. So for every death, the CDC tells us, we have 15 abuse treatment admissions, 26 emergency department visits, 115 folks who abuse or are dependent, 733 non-medical users, and $4.3 million in just health system costs. It doesn't have anything to do with the efficiencies or otherwise. So I've done the math for you. That's close to 4,000 emergency department visits. That's over 17,000 folks who use or are dependent. It's over 100,000 non-medical users, and it's over $600 million in healthcare system costs alone in Oregon.
Wow.
So there's tremendous opportunity and work to be done. We appreciate your help in letting us, and the opportunity to come and talk about it.
Okay, Nelson, you want the last word?
Yeah, I just think that there was one issue that popped into my mind. I think back, you know, with antibiotics, and everybody thought, well, if I'm sick, there must be an antibiotic for it. And people, they went to the doctors and said, oh, I need an antibiotic, and they wouldn't leave until they got one. We've slowly educated people that that isn't necessarily the best thing to do. And I think this is kind of like it. We need all sorts of different people and providers giving the message, not necessarily when they're on an 8 out of 10 pain giving the message, but giving the message broadly in public service announcements that, you know, just because you have pain doesn't mean you need a pill necessarily. And I think that's the biggest thing we need to focus on in a broad sense.
Yep. Well, thank you.
Thank you,
you very much,
Chairman.
It's very interesting. I expect we're going to be working on it for a while.
Thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to close the informational meeting.
Thank you, guys.
We are adjourned. Informational meeting.
Thank you, guys.
We are adjourned.